I'm Dr. Leif Tapanella from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho. It's wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Well, today our guest is Dr. Chuck Peterson, professor of biology at Idaho State University. We'll be talking about citizen science, ways that everyday people can help record important scientific observations about their natural world. Well, Peter, I'm really excited about this topic. It's sort of near and dear to my heart.
Well, I love it too. You know, one of our goals with Zoo Idaho is to inspire people to get out and use their natural world. How fun is it to be able to get out and then be part of scientific research?
Well, this is just the thing. As a researcher myself and being a professional researcher, I think sometimes folks don't realize that they can be part of recording that information in their everyday life. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to do it as your profession. You just have to have an interest. And today we're going to talk about ways that you can get involved. And we're really excited about that with our guest, Chuck. But before we do that, let's talk about a little nature news.
We're moving a little bit away from nature in the outdoor sense to talk about sad music.
Sad music.
Sad music actually evokes positive emotions. Researchers from Tokyo University asked 44 participants, both musicians and non-musicians, to listen to two pieces of sad music and one piece of happy music. And once they were done, the participants were then asked to rate their perceptions using a set of keywords that were given to them. And what they found out is that sad music actually might induce romantic emotions as well as sad emotions. And they think that this causes some really happy feelings once you listen to sad music. And they're hypothesizing that unlike sadness in daily life, sadness through music actually feels pleasant because it doesn't actually exist or last long. And this doesn't threaten their safety. And this could actually help people deal with their negative emotions in real life. So if you're feeling down, listen to a sad song.
That kind of reminds me of how people get enjoyment out of feeling frightened by a horror movie or something, knowing that it's really just play and they're really safe, but they're getting that sort of peak of excitement through the horror.
Yeah.
In a similar way, the sadness is not real, and so you get some kind of pleasure, maybe enjoying the fact that that sad thing isn't happening to you.
Right. And, you know, honestly, a lot of sad music is quite beautiful to listen to.
Absolutely. Well, you know, growing up with a lot of 90s music myself, a lot of it was very mopey, sad stuff, and it's still some of my favorite music, even though it's kind of dreary stuff if you listen to the words, but it makes me happy anyway.
Oh, and I've got one of my favorite musicians that his goal is to write the saddest songs in the world because sad music is beautiful, as he says.
Well, I agree with that for sure. Well, so today, for trivia time, of course, linking it to our program, all about citizen science, I've got a good one. This is how many observations have been recorded using the iNaturalist Citizen Science Program? We're going to talk a lot about iNaturalist today as a piece of software that allows you to get involved. Well, the question today deals with how many total observations have been made by citizen scientists so far on that software. We're going to answer that question and a whole lot more about citizen science right after the break.
This is KISU-FM Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg. Also available on your Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
All right, we're back from break. I want to welcome Dr. Chuck Peterson. He's a professor of biology here at Idaho State University. Thanks, Chuck, for joining us on The Nature of Idaho.
Well, thanks for giving me an opportunity to talk about a subject that I like very much.
Tell us a little bit about your background and what led up to iNaturalist.
Oh, okay. Well, I've been interested in nature and in particularly in amphibians and reptiles since as long as I can remember. I grew up on a lake during the summers in Wisconsin and got to spend most of my time looking for turtles and snakes and frogs. And so, and I like to say that I've been able to continue doing that into my professional career.
Sort of grew up, but not really completely grew up.
Yeah, I think herpetologists are people who study amphibians and reptiles, and they often say that they get to have a job that was what they wanted to do when they were 10 years old. So
that's wonderful.
And so I got to work in a zoo for a number of summers when I was working my way through high school and through college. And then, you know, became a professional herpetologist and came here in 1988. So this is my 32nd year at Iowa State University. And right from the beginning, I've been interested in the amphibians and reptiles of Idaho and understanding where they occur and what they're doing and how well they're doing, and work closely with a lot of the agencies and businesses like Idaho Power and Potlatch Timber and the Park Service and Fish and Game. And so this has just been a wonderful place.
Is this a pretty rich state for amphibians and reptiles?
Not relatively. We have 38 species of amphibians and reptiles. That's a fraction of what you'd find as you go south.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And things get warmer, then you'll find more and more species. And 80% of the amphibians and reptiles of the species occur in the tropics. But we have some wonderful, large, you know, interesting populations. One of the real benefits, well, a couple benefits of living in Pocatello have been proximity to the Tetons and Yellowstone, but also to the Snake River Plain and the Idaho National Laboratory, which has some phenomenal snake populations out there in relatively undisturbed areas. And so, oh, probably about half of my lab's research work for students has been focused on reptiles on the Snake River Plain.
That's right. So how does this get you to citizen science? Could you maybe tell us a little bit about what citizen science is as a even a definition? What does that mean?
Let me back up just a bit and say that, you know, over a period of 25, 30 years, our lab worked very hard at trying to accumulate as much information, you know, doing surveys around the state. And in a sense, we've only scratched the surface. And so we were working on a project about 5 years ago, and we realized that we were never going to get to where we wanted to go through our own activities, through graduate students and
undergraduates. Yeah, so help define the problem. The problem is you're looking for...
Our problem is documenting where amphibians and reptiles are throughout the state. But this is a general problem,
right,
you know, for plants and for animals. You might think that... I think the public often thinks we know a lot more than we really do. And then when you get in there and you realize that, you know, some of these things are not very well documented at all.
So how many faculty and grad students were kind of working on this project?
Well, in my lab, I've had over 30 graduate students, mm-hmm, and I've collaborated with, you know, scores of people around the state on this. So, I mean, we've done a lot of work. I mean,
right.
But again, it still does not come close, right, to...
We're looking at 30, 40, 50 people throughout this whole project. It's a small fragment of the amount of people that could be collecting data, correct?
Yeah. I've worked with some folks over at Idaho Fish and Game and their, you know, with their database group there, the Idaho Fish and Wildlife Information System. And they have this wonderful graphic where they show the number of biologists and then the number of people that are outdoors seeing all this, you know, and it's orders of magnitude more, you know. There's this tremendous amount of information that you can obtain. You know, if we could tap into what the public knows and experiences and sees, it would go a very long way toward helping us manage these things and conserve them properly. That's really the core of it. And when I helped out the Idaho Fish and Game for the State Wildlife Action Plan. And I'd say probably for most of the species of amphibians and reptiles, we don't have enough information to really accurately assess the status and trends of the populations. And then when we have, you know, kind of these huge declines, when like leopard frogs disappear from the majority of the state or things like that, you know, when you have serious problems, we often don't learn about them or even know about them until a decade later. And then you realize what has happened. And then it's probably too late to do much about it. And so the idea is if we can tap into this public knowledge and interest, it's not only getting the information, but it's really a fun thing to do. And it's enjoyable for people to do it. You know, people want to do that.
So citizen science, in a way, it's harnessing the numbers, the sheer number of non-professional observations that can be made by everyday folks in their daily business, if they're a hunter or if they're just out hiking or they're observing on their own. They have knowledge that can help when all of that information is pooled together, has some real impact and meaning.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know things now that we just didn't know 3 years ago. I would say that through our project, which focuses on amphibians and reptiles, the majority of the verifiable records now for reptiles in the state have been generated in the last 3 years in that project, at least the verifiable records that the state has access to.
So how does citizen science work?
Yeah. So, you know, citizen science actually can go back a long, long way. What we mean by citizen science, another term is sometimes crowdsourced data because it involves using digital means to transmit the data, you know, and to collect it. But people have been volunteer data is another thing too. People have been doing things like the, you know, Christmas bird count for over 100 years. And Idaho, the Park Service, for example, has had their rare animal observation forms, things like that. But in the past, so with citizen science now, what we think of it as often and crowdsourced data is having, often what you'll have is you'll have a scientist there that will help develop a project, but then they recruit people to work on that project. And so it has a direction and there's a level of quality control checking it. But the real work gets done by interested volunteers, people doing it on their own. And there's a tremendous variation in the different types of projects, the number of people involved, how much training is involved, and what's actually done, how the data are analyzed. But the part that I've been involved with has been trying to recruit people to, you know, use our recent technology of primarily, you know, mobile devices like smartphones, and use that to document the occurrence. You can make recordings of the calls. You can take photographs of the plants or the animals. And then that can be easily shared to a database very, very easily. And different organizations like the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology or iNaturalist, which is from the California Academy of Sciences, they've done the heavy lifting in the part. So then we can come in and utilize that platform to, you know, get information, and they, you don't have everybody reinventing the wheel. And then those data can be shared, easily shared. And it's almost like the one that we work with is like a social network where people can follow each other's observations and they comment on them and help people. A lot of it is helping other people identify. And you have people involved in citizen science that may not actually even be able to go out in the field themselves, but they help by helping other people make their identifications. I don't know what your experience is. I know amphibians and reptiles well. I don't know the plants or the insects very well. And so I can go out and find these interesting things, get a photograph of it, you know, post it using the iNaturalist program, and then have an expert help me identify it.
Let's back up a little bit and talk about iNaturalist, because I have a little familiarity working with it, using it with my kids. It's a really, really easy platform to get your, you know, feet wet immediately doing some citizen science and collecting data so easily with your cell phone. Tell us a little bit about iNaturalist.
It started about, just after the introduction, I think, of smartphones, within a year or two after that, by, I believe there were three graduate students at Berkeley, in, I think, a communications department, information. I'm not sure just which department, but it was a master's project. And they were not biologists. They were people that just loved natural history and wanted to create something that would help them share, you know, the experiences, document and share their experiences. And they developed this and they kept it alive until, I believe, 2011 or so, something like that, I think it was, that the California Academy of Sciences saw the value in that. And then, and I believe one of the original creators of the prep is one of the co-directors now of that program at the California Academy of Sciences. And so now there's different ways that you can use that program. What most people do is use a smart device, a mobile device like a smartphone. And you can take a photograph of something and then, the cameras or the smartphones have a GPS unit in them, a receiver, a global positioning system, so they can get usually quite accurate coordinates within a few feet of where you actually saw the things. The cameras are getting better and better. You know, they work real well for some organisms, like frogs and snakes. They're pretty well. If you got a bird flying a long ways away, it may be hard to get a picture of that. But you document it with the call or with a photograph. It dates, puts the date and time on the observation and can put the locality on there. And, you know, there's a tremendous value in getting this information, but it can be misused by some people. So to be on the conservative side, what they've done is if anything has threatened, endangered, or vulnerable species status, these are, you know, defined things by conservation organizations, then that they introduce some significant amount of error so you wouldn't know exactly where that is. And there are ways where you may be able to share the precise coordinates if you want. But anyway, and then you upload that. You know, you just, and you don't have to be connected to the internet. You could be in the middle of the wilderness area, and then when you get back to a Wi-Fi connection or something, then you could upload it. But it's been the nice thing about this program is it's used across a variety of taxa. The Rick Williams, the botanist at the Idaho Museum of Natural History and at ISU, he was the one that started the flora of Idaho, and he uses that for teaching his classes. And that's the largest iNaturalist. I think they've got almost 20,000 observations in that now.
That iNaturalist platform, it's an app that you download, and I put it on my phone. It's for free, right? And so I found it absolutely a breeze to use. It's really user-friendly, as you were saying. It's simply just take a photo, upload it to the site, and just as an example, in my backyard, I saw some brown-looking birds that were flying around, and my kid asked me what that was, and I said, I don't know, because I don't know my birds well. So I took a picture of it, nice, decent photo, and posted it on iNaturalist. And within a minute or two, I had three or four people responding right away, hey, that's a pine siskin. That's a pine siskin. That's a pine siskin. And they had it nailed right away. And now me and my kids know what a pine siskin is. Yeah. And it turns out to be a fairly common bird in our neighborhood, but we didn't know that before.
And this keeps a life list for you, too, automatically.
Okay.
That's right.
So you can go on to it. And the other side of this, so it is an app that you can use either on an Apple or an Android operating system. It's free. It's easy to use. You know, I give talks like to high schools and things. Before I'm done talking, they're downloading the app and entering the even pictures that you have on your phone already. You can add them
right
in. It doesn't have to be at that time. I've gone back to document some things that I wanted to record, observations that I made 20 years ago. And that the way you do that is you can do that through the website.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So even if you don't have a smartphone, you can still do this. In fact, the power users, they often use the outreach coordinator for iNaturalist came up here and did a workshop for us a year and a half ago, and we went out to City of Rocks, and I think he like doubled the number of species records because he uses a quite good mirrorless camera, and then he has it hooked with a GPS unit, and he just goes around shooting. He doesn't even use the app.
He's not even looking. He's just...
Yeah, he's just taking pictures of all the different things he sees, and then he puts it, and then at the end of the day, he can upload that, and it's far more efficient. But for the most part, I still try to get a picture of the habitat, and I get the coordinates and things with my phone.
I think a wonderful part about iNaturalist is, you know, as a scientist, we have to catalog a lot of data when we take one sighting, with location, time, weather, all this other good stuff. We don't have to worry about that with iNaturalist. We can take the picture, boom, and all that information that's needed to verify that photo was already done. And it's a fun way for us to help you out, Chuck, and other researchers, and it's a great way for us to learn a whole lot more about the environment we're living in.
Yeah, I feel I use it both ways. I mean, I got initially started to get data on amphibians and reptiles, but I probably have more observations on plants and on other animals than I do amphibians and reptiles.
It's a scientific scavenger hunt.
It's a scavenger hunt. It's a fun activity,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it's immediately, especially I find with the kids, they just love it immediately. And so they're looking for things to find and add to the
list. And one thing I should point out, too, is there are these security issues because, you know, whenever you make a observation, you essentially are creating a record of where you were.
Mm-hmm.
So with children, you cannot have your own iNaturalist account until you're 13 years old.
Okay. Right.
They have an app called Seek that allows you to learn how to use it. Oh, and it also has what they call computer vision. I don't know if you've played with this, but if you're connected to the internet, you take your picture and it will... It'll compare it to other photographs from your area, and it'll list what they think it might be.
Oh, that's
and so cool. It's really fun. I mean, it gives you a helping hand in identifying things.
So right now, I mean, we've kind of been talking about living things, animals and plants. Can iNaturalist be used for geologists as well?
No, iNaturalist is really for animals, but there are other great programs for that. There's programs, there's citizen science programs for recording precipitation that have like 100 times more sites. And now the Weather Service actually uses that data to improve their weather forecasting and reporting.
That's great.
And there's one, you know, that the geosciences department had a seminar, I think about a year ago. There's a hydrology monitoring. And it's increased, I think, the number of sites where people are taking water levels like by tenfold, engaging stations. And so, I mean, this is changing the game. And this this is not just fun stuff for people. This is big science now.
Right. So what this kind is of questions, huge. What kind of questions are we able to address because of the volume of data and the number of eyes that are out there now that are able to make observations? We have software and processes now that can bring all that data together, verify its quality. And now it comes to a researcher. What questions does this allow? What does it allow us to address that we couldn't before?
Well, for us right now, it's giving us a much finer resolution of the distribution of organisms, where right. they're found. So we're able to find, leopard lizards, actually, they occur up at Camas National Wildlife Refuge, extended the range of that, right. that species. There's a lot of different things, but I think the really getting to this point of big data and what you can do that you couldn't do before.
Sure.
The really large and most successful citizen science program for organisms is eBird.
Yeah.
And it's run by the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology.
Which is a wonderful website.
That's a fantastic website.
Fantastic. I mean, these guys are clearly way ahead. They you know, that group of people are doing wonderful work with all kinds of things, call recognitions. But they're getting to the point, well, if you go onto some of these websites and look, you can actually see the migrations of the birds, as it's happening.
Right.
I mean, today they're here. You can see animations. And now that they're getting, I think they're up into the hundreds of millions of observations. They're actually starting to be able to get at, questions of population status and trends. It's a very, very challenging program from a set of data to analyze because there's not an underlying study design.
Right.
There. These are called opportunistic observations, and they're what we call positive data only. They're not recording what you don't see. They're recording what you do see. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very big challenge, but people are working in a variety of ways to try to figure out. One of my master's students, that's his project, is trying to figure out how we can actually use these contributed data in a rigorous way, mm-hmm. To develop models of species distribution and trends and things.
We're going to give you guys some information on how to get access to iNaturalist. But if someone is looking to participate in a citizen science project, there's not necessarily one specific place for them to go. How would they
Actually, there are some. I believe CITSCI is one that tries to put a lot of that together. So there are some places. I think CITSCI is the one that CITSCI. And I think if you Google that, that would take you to one of these places that tries to pull that together and tie you into it. But it's kind of the Wild West right now. There's a lot of people doing these things and getting started. And we work with iNaturalist, and it's continually changing underneath us.
Right.
It's a challenge to keep up with their policy. And when I visited them, I got the feeling that they were more like a software startup. they were really running hard to keep up with the increase in interest and stuff.
Well, we really encourage people to check this iNaturalist out. Like I said, it's an easy one to get your feet wet and see what citizen science is all about. I started the program off with a trivia question about iNaturalist and how many observations so far have been recorded using the iNaturalist program. Chuck, what's the answer to that?
Last week, I think, they posted on Facebook. They have a Facebook group, and they hit 25 million observations.
25 million observations?
25 million.
How many years is that since they started about?
When we started our project in 2016, I think there were like 1.5 million.
Right.
And so I think it's coming in at maybe over 1 million observations a month now. It's really
increasing. So it's growing exponentially.
It's growing very
fast.
Good
job, everyone.
That's right.
We can all be a little bit of – we all have a little bit of scientist in us.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. We want to thank Dr. Chuck Peterson for joining us today. To get involved with iNaturalist and learn more about the program and download the free app, please visit the website iNaturalist.org. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at KISU.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. And please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.